Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. And thank goodness you are. We have Randall Schwartz from Floss Weekly joining us, as well as Deidre Keller, Evan Brown, and me. And please help us. We're being repressed. We're going to talk about Extreme Linux. We're going to talk about fair use, popcorn time, the latest from Aereo, and what the heck is the IRS doing to open source nonprofits? All next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 266, recorded July 11th, 2014. Corn Cops and Popcorns. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TWiL. Hi, folks. It's Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. Thank you so much for joining us this week. We took last week off, so it's great to be back after the 4th of July. Hope you had some good celebrating if you're here in the U.S. I know one of our guests has definitely been celebrating this week. Randall Schwartz is joining us from Floss Weekly, and you just had your 300th episode.
We did, in fact. It was really a privilege. It's been a privilege to do the show all along, but it was really fun also to have a celebratory show, 300 episodes long. We actually had Chris DeBona, who helped create the show with Leo way back in 2006, I think it is, actually, come on the show midway through as sort of a mystery caller. I brought him on, and I said, we have a caller. Who is this? And it turns out it was Chris. It was really fun. And so we got to talk about how he created the show, and he was happy for us that we'd gone all the way through. And it's a good time to reflect back. It was a lot of fun. I'm glad I got to do that.
I'm glad you did too. That is a great show to catch. Floss Weekly, of course, is a sister show of ours here on the TWiT network. And since open source software is all about pursuing a different kind of legal licensing strategy towards software and marketing and sales, or if there are even sales involved, we thought it would be a great complimentary thing to have Randall come on the show. I've actually wanted to have you on the show for a long time, so it's great you could join us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Also joining us is Deidre Keller from Ohio Northern University Law School, where she teaches a number of subjects that touch on intellectual property and the internet. Deidre, great to have you.
It is very nice to be here. Thank you.
Tell us about your background. How long have you taught at ONU, and what are you teaching next term?
Sure. I've been here at Ohio Northern since the fall of 2010. In the fall this year, I'll be teaching property to first-year students and intellectual property, the survey course. Before
Great.
I came
well,
here, I worked in trademarks and copyrights at law firms in Atlanta.
Very fun. We're thrilled to have you on the show as well. And coming off of his 4th of July celebration, my co-host Evan Brown. Hello, Evan.
Hey, Denise. Yeah, glad to be back. It was a nice break, but good to pick up the conversation again. Randall, good to finally meet you. Enjoyed the show as long as you've been on Floss Weekly. And Deidre, really nice to meet you. So we ought to have some fun today.
Cool.
We will indeed. Let's visit the technology and law intersection from last week's 4th of July celebrations in the U.S. Let's take a look at some video. I don't know about you guys, but as I was watching the fireworks in our community, we did spot a drone that was up. It didn't fly into the fireworks, but it was definitely taking video from right next to them. And we thought that was pretty gutsy about not just from a legal standpoint, but putting your drone in jeopardy. So there was a good story and follow-up story over at Forbes about the legal ramifications of doing this. And let's take a look at what we're talking about. So this particular drone, as I understand it from the coverage at Forbes, and I'm going to pull that up for you so I can tell you exactly who wrote those articles. One second here. as you could see, and you probably saw last week after the 4th, because this video was making the rounds, this and others, there was not just flying by, but into the fireworks involved. You know, the streaks of light going right by the drone. And obviously, it made for some spectacular video. But as Gregory McNeil, who himself is a law professor, he teaches at, let me find his school, scroll more quickly here. He teaches, I'm not sure where, but he teaches law and public policy. I'm going to pull up his background for you. He did a great story on this and the legal ramifications, and also got a follow-up from the FAA, who commented they were actually going to be investigating. I'm thinking that this year was probably the first year we had a good deal of drones in or near fireworks. He went into a long bio here. All right, we're actually going to try and get Gregory McNeil on the show to talk more about this. And here we go.
Are you sort of fighting with the Forbes bio over there? That's what I'm trying to do. It's like, wow,
I am. Yeah. No. He's a Forbes contributor, assistant director for the Institute of Global Security for the U.S. Department of Justice.
That was in a previous life, right? Yeah.
Lots of law review articles. I'm not sure where he's teaching these days. Well, we will, you can follow him on Twitter at Gregory McNeil. So hopefully, it will be more apparent there. He is all over the media in various places. Anyway, his point was that even if this particular fireworks display that we're watching it wasn't involved in the 4th of July, it happened earlier this year in May down in Florida, that there are all kinds of federal and possibly local regulations that would prohibit you from flying your drone into fireworks because of the safety considerations. The drone could get hit and obviously splinter and harm someone. The fireworks could get knocked off course and go somewhere where fireworks should not go, including sideways rather than up. So there are lots of reasons why drones and fireworks might not be something that you'd want to do. His point was that you could find yourself committing a federal crime under various laws if you went ahead and did this, thinking it would just be fun to get the great footage. So the FAA has actually responded to his request for comment, told him that it's looking into multiple incidents in which unmanned aircraft flew into fireworks displays to determine if there was any violation of federal regulations or airspace restrictions. They seemed to be more concerned with flights into fireworks than flights near fireworks. So Gregory concludes that's good for people who hope to safely create stunning videos of the displays. Just don't fly your drone right into them. So I just wanted to toss this out, see what you guys thought about it, see if I'm the only one who saw a drone buzzing around fireworks this year. Evan, any in your neck of the woods?
No, I was in southern Indiana and watching fireworks displays down there, and I didn't see any drones there. But I did, you know, see that video that was going around. It turns out it was actually filmed in May, right down in Florida, but it gained popularity over the 4th of July weekend, that one that we were showing there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, certainly an interesting issue. And yeah, a lot of these observations are pretty common sense. I think that Gregory's point was this could be a violation of different regulations, in as much as that's designated as a protected space. And so there's a certain period of time in which that space has a bit more sanctity or what have you, or you're more restricted on what you can do there, flying a drone through that. And so I think that's all well and good, and it's intriguing, and maybe the law's a little bit unsettled, and it would vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I'm sure not every space would be cordoned off as federal protected space, but there's also the risk that an individual would have with civil liability on this. I mean, good grief, you don't have to use your imagination a whole lot to see how this could go bad. The firework could, hit the drone itself and cause debris to be strewn about, or it could cause the the pyrotechnic itself to go off course. Those are things that he talked about. It seems like even just the percussion of the shell exploding could do some damage to the drone here. And if to the extent that causes injury, I don't think you're going to have much of a difficulty as a plaintiff in a tort case to say that the person flying the drone wasn't only reckless, but probably, or it wasn't only negligent, but was probably reckless, really consciously disregarding the substantial risk that could happen and that people could get injured there. So I think that's one point that's in the legal commentary. Haven't seen anything about that, but it's sort of self-evident, I believe, that, you know, doing this, you know, yeah, you could land in federal prison, but you could also find yourself being the defendant in a very expensive personal injury or worse, a wrongful death lawsuit as well. And that's nothing that we need to get all novel and evaluate too many novel legal issues to get to.
Randall, I suppose there's an open source spin to this, as I imagine there's a lot of open source software that must power drones out there.
Yeah, actually, we interviewed a couple of people who are doing the Open Pilot project, but I was going to come at this from a pilot perspective. I'm 270 hours in the left seat, and I'm sort of wondering if there was a TFR out, a temporary flight restriction rule, around this firework area. And if there was, then that would automatically make any flight of the drone, you know, a violation of federal rules. The other thing is that the chat room said this was less than a mile from one of the airports. And I know that also from reading the FAA reading on this so far, that if you're doing any kind of drone flying within 5 miles, you're supposed to notify the airport control tower. And so I'm wondering if there was a couple of aspects of this that were already just, you know, on its face wrong from that perspective. Because, you know, I'd hate to be, you know, trying to land a plane and have a little drone fly in front of me and, you know, either destroy the drone or have the drone be enough of a distraction that I'd also, you know, fail my ability to land. So, and these are becoming more commonplace. You know, back to the open source aspect of it, stuff like OpenPilot allows somebody who has almost no flight ability, back in the early days when you were running a quadcopter, you had to actually be about as good as a helicopter pilot in terms of managing, you know, the flow and the balance and all that. But now you've got stuff that you just type on a command. You can go to 50 feet. Now go to this GPS coordinates. And the thing has its own GPS and its own leveling, and it can just fly wherever it wants to. And they're so cheap now. They're, you know, for less than $500, you can buy the drone probably that video was taken with. And I'm concerned that we're going to see a lot more of these happening and we've got to really get the rules down.
Yeah, and it seems like the public really needs to be educated about what those rules are. One of Professor McGill's points in his couple of articles is that there are a lot of laws already on the books that are going to arguably apply to and make this activity actionable or possibly criminal without even, you know, enacting laws that specifically apply to drones. So I just don't think, you know, people pick up this their drone at the hobby store and launch it into fireworks or other areas. I don't think there's a real connection between what people are able to do and what the law would prefer they not do. Deirdre, do you have any thoughts on this?
I can say definitively there were no drones at fireworks celebrations here in Northwest Ohio. None that I saw.
Yep. That's good. Although, you know, we saw a lot of interesting stuff flying around this year. Not just, you know, we live on a strange sort of precipice between two communities, one where fireworks are illegal and one where they are. So all you really have to do is walk over the border and you've completely entered another universe where things are flying around that clearly are not legal. But I think law enforcement's just so overwhelmed on the 4th of July that they can't squelch every bit of the illegal activity. So, you know, the more drones that are flying around, the more that even gets complicated. Let us move on to some copyright stories in the news this week. Let's talk about fair use briefly. We are coming up on yet another presidential campaign era. And Deirdre has written in the past about using copyrighted political content in political campaigns. This is something that seems to come up every single time the politicians start running national ads. There is oftentimes music or news footage used in those ads that is important for getting the message across in varying degrees. And invariably, somebody comes along and decides that has violated our copyright and that you don't have permission to use it. So, Deirdre, I wonder if you could kind of set the stage for us for what you think the state of the law is on this issue and what you think we might see happen as the campaigns start to ramp up.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. You're right, Denise, that this happens every presidential election season, right? So the iconic Obama Hope poster was the subject of a long and drawn out copyright litigation. And the paper that I wrote is actually about the Romney campaign's use of NBC News footage in the primary and aimed at Newt Gingrich. So Romney used some footage from back during Newt Gingrich's ethics problems in the House. And that's all that was in the ad, right? Was Tom Brokaw talking about Newt Gingrich's ethics problems. Well, NBC immediately was like, take it down. Do not use this. This is our copyrighted content. Brokaw also had some right of publicity claims. They asserted some Lanham Act sounding claims. And the Romney campaign took the ad down. So that happens over and over again. Part of the reason for that is because since 1984, the Supreme Court has said basically that the First Amendment, all First Amendment protections in the copyright context are inherent in the Copyright Act. So basically what that means is that courts don't do an additional First Amendment scrutiny on in copyright suits. Instead, they say, does idea expression dichotomy help you? If not, does fair use help you? If not, you, that is the defendant, Romney, in the situation that I'm talking about, loses, right? So this idea that the First Amendment doesn't need, or that copyright infringement claims aren't susceptible to First Amendment charges, though, hasn't been worked out in the political setting, right? So we haven't seen a court directly address whether use of copyrighted content in political campaigns requires an additional First Amendment inquiry. Certainly we haven't seen that from the Supreme Court. There have been some district court decisions, and they go the idea expression dichotomy fair use route. So the state of the law right now is that, as a general matter, courts considering whether there's a copyright infringement don't ask First Amendment questions. They say either it's a fair use or it's not a fair use. And if it's not a fair use, you, the alleged infringer, have to take the stuff down. That means political campaigns have to take down their advertisements, right?
Yes, absolutely. So what do you think? Do you think we have any clarity on this? Do you think we'll see candidates actually paying attention to this issue and their marketing staffs doing so, so that they don't have to have controversy about this after the fact? Or do you think that they will continue to trip over the issue?
I think that they've been tripping over the issue for a long time, and mm-hmm. I think they're going to continue to do so, right? It seems sort of odd, especially in the context of news footage, to say you can't use that footage for this purpose, right? For your political campaign. I mean, if a court actually addresses that and says that's right, NBC's copyright disallows that use, then what that means is that we have NBC footage that's only going to be available for use by, let's be real, Democrats, right? And Fox footage that's only going to be available for use by conservatives. And that seems to me to not be the right answer. Nonetheless, campaigns do this, right? They use songs that people don't want them to use. So Mitt Romney got in trouble in 12 for using Kanon's Waving Flag, which seemed like an odd choice in any event. But no, campaigns do this over and over again. And copyright owners get in trouble, or copyright owners yell about it over and over again. So I think it's going to continue to happen.
Right. Evan, do you think that courts are going to start to say, look, if it's news coverage used for a political purpose, there could scarcely be a more clear, fair use case? Or are we going to continue to see networks being able to tie up their coverage like this?
Well, I'm really intrigued to see how this would go. And that's why I'm interested in what Deidre has written about this in the way it sounds like it's more than a fair use analysis, but it's more of a pure First Amendment constitutional analysis about this. Mm-hmm. And it underscores the importance of this kind of speech. You know, political speech seems to be afforded the widest latitude under any First Amendment type of analysis. You know, there's very little restriction on political speech. And with when we have the intersection of that First Amendment interest there and the right to speak freely about political issues balanced against the copyright issue, the copyright interest that the content producer, the news media, the broadcaster, whomever has, it seems like if we're going to open that up quite a bit and say that you could use any footage of a political event or advertising or what have you, in as much as it's usable, in as much as it relates to the current election and the political issues there. And it seems like that could really be a slippery slope that could go to the detriment of the content holders pretty quickly. Because if the courts are going to read that right very expansively, then what would not qualify as a fair use or as this other kind of use? And Deidre, maybe you can clarify on how I'm thinking of the analysis here. You know, this other, you know, broad use in addition to a fair use right, you know, what's to stop somebody from essentially just setting up a business model where you rebroadcast over the air signals. I'm mixing two stories here, right? No,
are there tiny antennas involved?
Right.
No. But say, there are say no you tiny just, antennas, not aerial.
Right. So you take, you know, the broadcasters programming in October and November of, you know, every 4 years, 2012, 2016, or whatever, and just rebroadcast that and say, hey, this is my political right to, or, you know, my right under the First Amendment to have this political speech here. And you're essentially just rebroadcasting that. I mean, with that, it seems like there's a risk if we're not careful in defining the contours here, that right could just be so great that it swallows the rule. The exception would swallow the rule.
Right. So I think the limitation here is thinking about what courts have previously considered political speech, right? Evan is right to point out that political speech gets the widest possible latitude, but not everything is political speech. So when you're talking about the qualifications of a candidate for office, that's political speech. That's at the heart of what we understand as political speech, right? You get far afield from there, and maybe it's not political speech anymore, right? So the question of sort of how broad this rule can get is, I think, and the argument that I make in the paper, is a question that we should approach from the First Amendment perspective as opposed to from the copyright perspective, right? From the copyright perspective, all protected content is protected content. From the First Amendment perspective, the first question we have to ask is this political speech? And so I think in the case of the Romney situation, it absolutely was political speech, right? Mitt Romney clearly was using that footage to make a statement about Newt Gingrich's qualification or lack thereof to hold the office for which he was campaigning. That's political speech.
Can I jump in for a second, Deidre, and have you explain, like you were explaining to your law students in their IP class, why it makes a difference? You know, if we come at this from a First Amendment standpoint or an intellectual property copyright standpoint, why thinking about it in First Amendment terms takes copyright off the table, if it does?
Sure. So, well, actually, it's sort of the opposite way, right? It's mm-hmm. that if we approach this question from the copyright perspective, that takes the First Amendment off the table. Mm-hmm. Why? Because in 1984 in Harper and Row, the Supreme Court said, when we're talking about copyright infringement, we don't really need to do a First Amendment analysis because the Copyright Act already incorporates the idea expression dichotomy, which means you can use the ideas and the facts in a copyrighted work. You just can't use the work itself. And because we have fair use. And so these two things that are in the Copyright Act mean you don't have to really do a First Amendment consideration in copyright infringement cases. Since 1984, that's been the Supreme Court's position on the intersection of the First Amendment and the Copyright Act. And we had that come up again and go the same way in Eldred, and then again in Golan v. Holder. So that's the Supreme Court's position, right? So it's actually the question then is, does that position hold when the speech in question is political speech? And I suggest that it shouldn't.
Got it. Well, we are looking forward to seeing the politicians trip all over each other once again as they attempt to put catchy yet unauthorized music and bits of controversial news footage in their ads. The last thing I'd like to bring up in terms of this discussion is there was another incident with Romney, I'm remembering, where he was at a small, closed, non-public fundraiser, but somebody filmed him with their phone and got him on record making some remarks to people at the fundraising event that he may, you know, may not have made in public, or that may have contradicted other things that he said in public. I forget exactly what he said, but it was sort of like a gotcha moment when this footage that someone in attendance had captured got released. Do you think that kind of a situation, when we're not talking about a news outlet, but a member of the public sort of doing their own citizen journalism here, does that shade the discussion at all?
Right. So this is the 47% comment, which I remember very well from the 2012 election. It was sort of a thing, right? For a while.
It was a thing.
So the question there definitely isn't a copyright question, right? Because the person who captured the footage is the author under the act. They own the content. They can do with it what they please. The question really there is like a privacy right of publicity question. So whether Romney has a basis for saying, no, you can't use that footage because my right of publicity or my right of privacy. Of course, that's an untenable thing to do. And I mean, I think as a practical matter, it's untenable for the candidate to say, you can't use this footage of me. Like you can't get your aha moment. That's just not going to work. In terms of the public accepting that as the right answer. So I don't know that there's a question about whether Romney could litigate that. I think that it's silly to think that he would, right? Because in the heat of the campaign, you don't want to be engaged in sort of that side legal issue. And you certainly don't want to be looked upon as if you're trying to cover things up.
All right. So let's move out of the political arena for a bit and into people's living rooms, where they want to be watching all the entertainment that is available to them online. Sometimes they want to be doing that in an illegal way under copyright law. Popcorn time is something that we've talked about before on the show, and that has moved into the open source world. Once the original site was shut down, now they have an open source iteration of Popcorn Time that lives at timeforpopcorn.eu, where it continues to be developed. It's, you know, continues to be as I think full-featured as the original was, and may, you know, be adding even additional benefits that the original Popcorn Time did not have. For example, they now have support for Chromecast. So it is just continuing to chug on in the open source world. It doesn't make it any more legal, but it makes it more robust and able to survive. So I wanted to get your take, Randall, on this kind of a situation. And, you know, this is obviously a quite public one, but I imagine this is not the first time you've seen something that had trouble in the commercial arena going open source in order to continue.
Well, it's interesting that they made it open source to begin with, or else we wouldn't be talking about the fork that's apparently happened here.
Right.
As far as copyright's concerned, I've made my living off of copyrighted materials for most of my life. So, of course, I have a stance on that. I do sympathize with people that recognize that merely watching a copy of something is not depriving the original owner of the original copy. So I do have some sympathy for what these guys are trying to do. And in fact, I saw a comment somewhere that in one of these articles, somebody said this is proof that the people that own this material aren't making it available in ways that we want to consume it. And we would pay money to do stuff like this if there was only an easy mechanism for it. But yeah, that's it. So we'd have a whole separate discussion on how I think the copyrights are way too long now. I actually think the copyright should go away after 14 years, but that's a whole different discussion.
Yes. You want to go back to the beginning, huh, Randall?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's silly. And here I am, you know, next to Disneyland right here, and how Disneyland seems to make sure that Mickey Mouse stays copyrighted by continually paying off the right politicians to extend the law longer and longer. I'm of the belief that for the first 7 years, you should have exclusive rights that the current copyright law provides. For the next 7 years, it has to be Creative Commons with attribution, because that way, if you can't make your fortune in the first 7 years, then you don't deserve to be making money with it. And if you can't make your fame in the next 7 years, you don't deserve that either. And I think that should be the rule. I would put all the stuff I do under a two-tier system like that. And if, after 14 years, it's public domain.
Well, that's a cool strategy. I like that one. Evan, do you think that Popcorn Time, by making itself open source and now involving lots of people in its development and distribution, is doing anything more than delaying the inevitable?
Well, I think it could make it more difficult for copyright holders, you know, the plaintiffs in whatever litigation that would arise, make it more difficult to go after them in the same way that it's more difficult to go after, you know, distributed terror networks than it was the Nazis. So it's I think there are a couple of interesting ways of looking at it. I don't think that the real legal questions change when we evaluate it in light of it being distributed versus it being one entity, or, you know, just a sort of a discrete group of entities working on it. Because I think we got to look at cases like, well, I think the Grokster case is one way to look at it. What is being done in connection with the marketing of it to see whether this tool is being put into the marketplace to induce others to infringe copyright? I don't think there's any question that the distribution of these works using the BitTorrent protocol is a direct infringement by the users. I think there's very few authorized versions of the works being watched through Popcorn Time. Maybe I'm mistaken. So, you know, things like the idea of a new VPN support being built into new versions of Popcorn Time, I think that would go against the development, whether it's, like I say, whether it's distributed or whether it's relatively coherent. That would go against them in the Grokster kind of analysis, because, well, why is that being used? It's to obfuscate the identity of the person who's using it, as if to promote it being used for infringing purposes. And I'm sure we can debate that. I mean, that's it might be too bold of an assertion to make, but I think that a plaintiff in a copyright action would certainly advocate that that's what that means in the course of the development. I think it's sort of just for kicks fun to think of Popcorn Time now to apply the Aereo test to it. You know, is what it's doing look like a cable company? You know, that's the test we have now. Does it so resemble a cable company that its very existence and use in the marketplace by those who are not authorized by the copyright holders in the works that are being distributed by it now come under the rubric of the Copyright Act as a cable company, and therefore subject to the compulsory licensing fees under the Copyright Act and all that stuff? I think ultimately at the end of the day, it doesn't, because it's really not like a cable company. It's more like a file sharing service. It's not it's not like a cable company as much as what Aereo was, but sort of just at least fun to think about. Aereo gives
it's
us
not
new,
intercepting
new
anything with an antenna. I mean, right. I think that fundamentally distinguishes it from Aereo, but.
Yeah, I've just been eager to put the Aereo test to you know, practical application. You know,
it's all Aereo. Exactly. Well, there's you know, to Randall's point, there it's always fun to see, or I don't know, interesting to see what is leaving and coming to Netflix as the months go by. A bunch of there's a huge list. I'll put it in our discussion points at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/266 if you want to look at the whole list. of things expiring from Netflix this month. Aeon Flux, that's a favorite in our household. Doctor Strangelove, not going to be able to watch that one anymore. From Russia with Love, Gattaca, Goldfinger. So a lot of the Bond catalog is going away. That's disappointing. All the Rocky movies. Sometime next year. I don't know if that's the same as same time next year. Ooh, Netflix did a lot of marketing around having every Star Trek property on the service at one point or another. But two of the Star Trek movies seem to be going away. Star Trek 2 and Star Trek 4 are going away. The Running Man, The Odd Couple. Of course, they add new things each month too. But to Randall's point, you know, if you're hot on the trail of seeing one of those movies and you're looking to Netflix as your legal and paid for source, oftentimes you come up empty and are disappointed. I do think that it would be a really interesting legal argument on the Grokster inducement point, Evan, for it to go after a service like Popcorn Time. And try and argue that what they're doing is inducing infringement. They're certainly making infringement more convenient. But would you be able to show, as the rights holder, that the person in question, the infringer, the user, would not have just gone out and torrented these anyway in a less convenient manner? And I don't know if that would play into the legal argument or not, but it seems like they've got a causation problem, don't you think?
I do. I mean, you'd have to, if the developers of Popcorn Time aren't being overt in their communications, you know, hey, go out and infringe with this. Like, you know, there was some direct evidence like that right. In the Grokster case. I'm overstating it. It wasn't like, hey, go use this to infringe, but it was pretty clear that that's what they were developing it for. You know, without that, you'd only have the circumstantial evidence. And I don't think we have a lot of guidance from the courts in the past 9 years since Grokster on really what you have to look for from an evidentiary standpoint to prove that there is that conduct that is prohibited under Grokster, or at least the conduct under Grokster that makes it an infringement. You know, really, we've just got the ISO Hunt case. That's sort of the best guidance we have, but those were pretty blatant facts as well. We don't have any decisions that I know of where a court has looked at real subtle set of facts, a real subtle fact pattern to say, hey, yes, here, this meets the Grokster standard of inducement. You know, so it's still yet to be determined how, you know, how that would play out when you don't have real good direct evidence. And perhaps with Popcorn Time, I have no idea what the state of reality is when it comes to that. But, you know, if it could be with Popcorn Time that there is just only a subtle hint that they're using this to induce infringement. So it could be interesting.
Well, in a moment, I want to get to Aereo embracing its cable company characterization as it is tagged by the Supreme Court. But we should drop in our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. We have lots of people who listen to the show for mandatory continuing legal education credit. And with great law professor guests frequently joining us, I can see why. Deidre Keller on with us this week from ONU and the rest of us struggling to keep up. So if you are listening for MCLE credit or hoping to do so, we have some information for you over on the TWIT Wiki. You go to wiki.twit.tv and find This Week in Law there. We have a 50-state survey over there that tries to tell you what you can do, what body to go to, and how you should keep track of your time spent with us here on the show. And in some of those jurisdictions, they like to know that you have some sort of verification system in place that they can come to us, or you can go to them and say, look, you can check me. I've listened to the show because I have caught the words that they've put in the show for just this purpose. And our first phrase for this week is going to be applying Aereo, since that's what we all seem to want to do in the wake of the Supreme Court decision. And why don't we talk about Aereo, head on over to the entertainment arena and see what they're doing now that they've had this decision come out of the Supreme Court. So our friend Eric Gardner has written over at the Hollywood Reporter Esquire, his blog. He's good about checking dockets and making sure he knows when documents are filed in cases as they continue on, and then helping us make sense of the party's filings. And what Aereo has done is file a letter to the judge at the district court level, Judge Allison Nathan, which gives us some hints as to where they are going and how they are construing what happens next under the Supreme Court's decision. And what they've gone ahead and done, according to this letter, they go ahead and say, mea culpa, after the Supreme Court's decision, Aereo is a cable system with respect to those transmissions. They also go on to report that they're proceeding to file the necessary statements of account and royalty fees necessary to get a statutory license. Once they have that license, their retransmissions may not be enjoined preliminarily or otherwise. So, it may be that they're going to try and keep the company alive and pay the license fees. Do you have any thoughts on this, Deidre?
Yeah, so I am not terribly surprised that this is the route that they took. Mm-hmm. The loss at the Supreme Court hinged on this question, right? Is Aereo a cable provider? And all that it means to be called a cable provider is that you have to pay for what Aereo was getting for free before, right? So all they're saying is, yes, we're willing to pay. That should, it seems to me like the broadcasters should be happy with that.
Absolutely. It seems to me like they should as well. Question whether Aereo's business model can support the fees that they would have to pay. Maybe they just pass those costs along to customers who want to continue to use the service. Do you think that's what we'll see happen?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. For sure, the cost of Aereo goes up, right? Because yeah. How else do you provide this service that you're paying for, that you weren't previously paying for? Yeah, customers will pay more for Aereo. And whether customers will be willing to pay more, I think, is a separate question that we're going to have to wait and see on.
Evan, did this surprise you?
No. It seems like it's a viable plan B for Aereo. There were millions of dollars that have gone into developing this technology, including, you know, VC funding, and those investors are going to want to see a return on that investment. So it wouldn't make any sense for us to have seen Aereo just put this technology on a shelf and not try to do anything at all with it. So they've got to do something. I can see why the broadcasters are frustrated by this tactic as well. If we look at it just purely from a litigation standpoint, Aereo did not raise the idea of it being a cable operator as an affirmative defense in the litigation. So if you just, and again, I'm encouraging you just to look at this as a litigator right now, you know, it's frustrating when your opponent tries to raise new arguments, and oftentimes the court won't allow new arguments to be made after a time has passed when you've, you know, given up, when you've decided to take one route and you can't really switch arguments a little bit later. So you can see why the plaintiffs are frustrated in this at the lower court level. Anytime a party uses the word that they're astonished by something, I always get a little bit, a little red flag goes off that says that there's probably a little bit of righteous indignation that's perhaps going a little bit overboard when it comes to that. That's probably more lawyer speak than it may be with the broadcasters, but I don't know. I can't speak for the broadcasters, of course. So, you know, you can see why they are frustrated in this. But for Aereo, I think there's a couple of different ways it can turn out looking good in this situation, or more precisely how it could look or how it could benefit from having taken this tactic here. The first one is, okay, fine, it is determined to be a cable company. It starts paying compulsory licensing fees under Section 111. And, you know, I've heard commentators say that that's not going to be all that expensive for Aereo. It's something that they'll certainly be able to afford, and it's not going to put it out of business. And the other advantage, or the way that Aereo could turn out looking good with this, is if it gets this, if it gets the lower court to craft an injunction against it, it would carve out of that injunction only those things that the Supreme Court talked about. And as we have discussed now in two or three different episodes, the Supreme Court said that Aereo violates copyright because it is so much like a cable company, in as much as it does this simultaneous, almost in real time, retransmission, rebroadcast of the over-the-air signals, which implies then leaves untouched the idea of Aereo as a remote DVR service. So if we get the court to say, yes, you are a cable company, yes, you pay these compulsory licensing fees, okay, fine, they have that as a business model, but then they also have open to them, free of any obligation to pay compulsory licensing fees, this the provision of this service as a remote DVR, where you still capture the signal over the air, make a personal time shifted, place shifted copy of it, which arguably would be fair use under the Sony case from again from 1984. It seems like 1984 is a real touchstone here, and you know, that would open that up for Aereo as a business model.
All right. Well, we will continue keeping an eye on Aereo and how it's going to proceed in the future. I'm wondering, Randall, if some open source developer or developers out there are looking at a way to do their own version of Aereo by taking little antennas and retransmitting content, and again, following the lead of Popcorn Time or others, making it more distributed makes it more difficult to get at the principles. Do you think that anything like that might be in the offing?
Well, it's certainly possible, but I haven't heard of anything personally, so I don't have anything to comment on that.
All right. Let's talk about the world of open source for a while. We have not had it come up too much on This Week in Law in a while, which I think is a good harbinger for the world of open source. The SCO versus Linux litigations have sort of gone by the wayside, and I have not had a lot of exposure to controversies about using open source software, which a lot of IP lawyers for a long time have wondered whether open source was going to be able to cut it in the enterprise because of the way in which the software comes together and the uncertainty about sourcing. And the SCO versus Linux case being a good example of how that can lead to problems down the road. But it seems like it has settled down into something that is not just useful, but necessary to businesses. Do you agree?
Yeah, and I think part of it is that we've gotten a lot further down the line. I mean, it's open source is no longer novel, and I think that's part of what's happened. Also, organizations like the OSI have published, you know, a bunch of licenses that say if you're publishing under one of these licenses, we've had, you know, careful examination to say that one of these licenses will work, and we can defend it, and we can make it work. And when I say open source is no longer novel, I mean a lot of big companies now are turning to open source and turning to mature projects like Linux and Apache and things like that to get their services done. And mm-hmm. they're recognizing the boundaries of things like the GPL. If they republish this stuff, that means they also have to open up their own source that was attached to that. I also know a lot of projects are also moving more towards Apache-style licenses, BSD-style licenses that are a lot more liberal about, you know, I can go ahead and publish this, and I don't have to publish my own source code. And a lot of businesses are adopting and embracing projects that are under those sorts of licenses as well. So I think it's the maturity. I think we've got sort of the kinks worked out. We kind of know where the boundaries go. And I think that's why you're not hearing so much about it in terms of litigation going on now, because we're past the hump. We're mainstream now.
Mainstream and yet still extreme, according to the NSA. Let's talk about some privacy ramifications of reading the Linux Journal. So although Linux and Apache and various other open source materials and software and tools are, as you were saying, Randall, part of the fabric of business, certainly in our country and around the world these days. I guess that reading Linux Journal can still be considered an extreme activity. Can you bring us up to speed on that?
Well, I did find this story a bit unusual. You know, it seems like if these keyword lists are coming from something maybe 10 years ago, that would make sense. But I mean, you know, the, if they're flagging all uses of people visiting Linux, you know, the Linux materials at Linux Journal and other places, they're probably flagging themselves, because I know the NSA is using tons of Linux installations internally, from what I've heard from friends of mine that can actually talk about that. So I don't know why, you know, this, a lot of this stuff is coming out because of Snowden and the other revelations is because of stuff that happened 5 or 10 years ago. So I imagine that would make it a little bit more extreme. I also saw in the keyword list things like, you know, torrent and Tor and things like that. And that makes more sense to me, because if you're talking about, you know, using Tor, using torrents to share information and steganography and things like that. Yeah, if you're trying to flag some things, clearly those would be good, useful keywords.
So this comes from a story from a German site called, oh gosh, my German is not going to allow me to pronounce this, Tagesschau, possibly, Tagesschau, that is revealing some information about how the NSA targets people for surveillance, and that various sites, including Boing Boing and the Linux Journal and Tor, might be targeted for long-term surveillance and retention by the NSA. So I don't know if this is too big a surprise. You know, I mean, do we all just assume these days that all of our activities are going to be suspect in one way or another and gathered by one agency or another? But this one was in the news this week, and it does seem sort of ludicrous that, you know, if there is some credence to what's being reported here with X key score and how it decides which traffic to review and keep, that perhaps it may be a little broader than is necessary for pure national security purposes. Evan, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, you know, from time to time, at least once before, I have, I haven't characterized it as giving it an award, but I've characterized it as this being like Dennis the Peasant in Monty Python's Search for the Holy Grail, you know, where at the end he goes, help, help, I'm being repressed, you know, when King Arthur lays hands on him. So I'm going to put this in that category for review to see if it qualifies for that, because this is great headline grabbing stuff. Look at us, look at us. We are being singled out. We are being persecuted. And all that stuff. By having come to this site now to read this article, you are on the NSA's watch list, and all your communications belong to us, and all that stuff. So, you know, I think that the information that we have about this doesn't necessarily say that you're going to be, you know, in the NSA's sites, but it could be. What this does not preclude is that if you are a Linux enthusiast and, you know, you seek out information about Linux, including visiting linuxjournal.com, that, you know, that may be one factor in several that would put you within the scope of X key score and all of that stuff. So, you know, it's great. It's one of these great things for Linux Journal to write about. And I'm not unsympathetic with that, because, you know, heaven knows that I am have a lot of disdain for the idea of the NSA being too grabby in you know, storing communications and getting this stuff. But at the same time, I'm just using the ordinary caution of just let's be careful about what we're reading about before we cast judgments on how much of an outrage it really is. It may be entirely outrageous, and this could be one of the things where we all need to go grab our pitchforks right now, but it may not. And so let's take a breath before we do that.
Okay. I will leave the pitchfork in the corner for the time being.
Put it down.
Over in England, I'm not sure if people are so willing to leave their pitchforks. The Open Rights Group has been examining the web filters in use there. We've talked about those web filters put in place earlier by the British ISPs. Imposing filters on new broadband customers unless specifically asked not to do so. Open Rights Group decided to see how those filters were working and took 100,000 sites and decided to run them through the filters and find out how many would actually be viewable where normal was the level of filtering that was set. It found that 20,000 of those sites were blocked by at least one ISP, so a fifth of the web. And I got to say, the first time I was reading through this story, it's written by Emma Woollacott at Forbes. I went, really? Only one fifth of the web is flagged as porn? But I'm not sure if their 100,000 sites included any actual porn sites. I'm assuming that what they were trying to do was see how many false positives would be brought in, and that with actual non-adult sites, they were still getting 20,000 out of 100,000 blocked. I'm not, you know, I'm not well versed in their methodology, but that's my assumption here in reading this coverage. So obviously that's problematic if there are sites, like the one highlighted here in this Forbes article is a site which focuses on reproductive health care, violence against women, and LGBT rights being caught by the filter, and that site being sherights.com. And obviously if sites that are not pornographic are being filtered here, then that's a cause for concern, much like if Linux enthusiasm is getting you on a higher priority NSA watch list, that would be cause for concern. Evan, is this again, you know, something where we should wait and see and not get the pitchforks, or you think pitchforks are in order here?
I don't know. Pitchforks are probably more in order here. I mean, good thing this is England and not the United States, because this is why we, and, you know, I'll let Deidre talk about this from the First Amendment perspective. I mean, this is why we have the analysis that we do here on content-based restrictions on speech, is because of the risk that it's going to be over broad. You're going to sweep too much stuff into the restriction that is legitimate speech here. So what's old is new again. You know, this is the same kind of stuff that went on in 1996 and before with the Communications Decency Act, trying to, you know, put restrictions on pornography in U.S. internet traffic. So, yeah, this is why you know, we ought to feel patriotic on holidays like the 4th of July, because we have the First Amendment in the analysis that goes under it. Don't you agree, Deidre?
Yes, I absolutely agree. And I think what's implicated here is the freedom to listen, which is a thing, the freedom to read, right? Incorporated in our First Amendment is not just the freedom to speak, it's also the freedom to listen. Mm-hmm. And so what's crazy about this story to me is that you have to opt out. Right, you have to ask for these filters not to be applied as the customer. I'm thinking that wouldn't fly on this side of the pond.
Yeah, I'm thinking that it wouldn't too, that people would be pretty concerned. Or, you know, I do think that the problem on the UK side is that it was mandatory on the ISPs. They didn't have a choice. They had to institute these filters. And at least in the US, I think it would be more of a free market thing, that if you wanted to have an ISP and market yourself as, hey, you know, we're going to be that ISP that's going to be safe for your family, people willing to go along with having an overbroad filter would pay the price and go with that ISP. I would think that kind of thing would be more acceptable here. And First Amendment okay, perhaps, rather than having the government come in and say, thou shalt have filters. What do you think about that, Deidre?
I think that's exactly right. I think an opt-in system would obviously work here, but this, you have to opt out or else the government says what you can and can't see on the internet, that's not going to work. I mean, our courts have long said that we're not going to make it so that the only content that's available is content that's safe for the most vulnerable, right? For children. And that seems to be kind of what's going on over there.
Denise, right, in the IRC, Randall says you may want to say something about opting out. That, you know, that, because I do think that plays into the fact you can opt out, and just to sort of pick up on what you were saying, Deidre, there, but and how that would play into the First Amendment. Randall?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just noticing that this is, you know, if this is, it may not be obvious that I've got the filter in place unless I'm going to one of these sites that were blocked. But if it is, you know, a simple phone call or email to say, no, I don't want that filter anymore, I'm willing to take full responsibility for what I see in my house, I don't really see a problem with this. The list of sites that was blocked was sort of interesting. But, you know, if what you're trying to do is provide a safe, well, you can't provide a safe internet in the first place. There's just no way, because you can't know all the possible sites that need to be blocked. I'm also curious how they came up with the first 100,000 sites, you know, most 100,000 most popular sites on the net or something. I don't know. So the methodology is flawed from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can see ISPs collecting big dossiers then. Here's the list of all the perverts that want to be able to view porn. These are the ones who called us up and want to do that. Or, you know, I mean, but, you know, going at to what you're saying about opting out, though, I mean, there isn't, and again, I'm going to look at the data on this. Isn't there this idea in First Amendment jurisprudence that any restriction on speech is really, really bad, and we've got to be, you know, combat that, even if it's just for a limited period of time? Couldn't that doctrine play into this? You know, you're being deprived of this First Amendment interest in viewing and seeing and listening to this content in that time period when maybe you're unaware that it's being blocked, and then you, the time period that you have to wait for the ISP to unblock it. Am I mixing up two separate things there, Deidre?
No, I think you've got that right, Evan. I think that there is the idea that it's the blocking in the first place, right? You were right to note that we don't like content-based censorship, essentially. That is our first, it's repugnant to our First Amendment, the notion of content-based restrictions. And so that's why I think this opting out thing doesn't really work to overcome that problem.
Yeah, the other problem with opting out is you may want to have your filter in place, but be able to access certain sites that are being swept in there that are perfectly fine, you know, that are not objectionable things that the filter is put in place to block. And I don't, you know, I don't know how readily and any ISP would be able to give you those fine tuning kind of tools that, you know, will let that one through, but not the others. Maybe, you know, again, if you leave it to market purposes or market forces, trying to make the service as user-friendly as possible, then maybe you would get that kind of functionality. But I don't know that that's what we're talking about here in a mandatory program in place in the UK. We're going to go ahead and put our second MCLE passphrase in the show, getting back to what you might find yourself subjected to if you're reading that incendiary Linux journal. We're going to make extreme Linux our second phrase for the show. And before we go on to some other open source topics, I wanted to pick your brain, Randall. I remember a long time ago looking at the developers agreement for Linux and seeing in there some indemnity language. So that if you're someone who is actually making contributions to the Linux kernel and helping further that ecosystem, you were actually asked to sign, you know, represent a warrant, I don't know, you know, e-sign, however you're entering into an agreement that what you're contributing is your own work product, or you have all of the rights necessary to contribute that work to the project. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, well, that's really, really problematic. How are you going to get individual indemnities from all the contributors? And how are you going to enforce that? You know, is it really something that you're going to come back and go to some individual developer and say, hey, you know, you actually use some other unauthorized code here, and now it's part of Linux, and shame on you. Do you know if that's still a part of that ecosystem or what the status of that is?
That's actually pretty typical for a contributor agreement to be able to say, I own this code. I have the rights to transfer my copyright ownership over to you. A lot of large projects have copyright transfer like that. A lot of them, though, actually work under more of a collective agreement in that I contribute to, say, a project, but I don't assign the copyright. So I'd still copyright Randall Schwartz on the piece of code I contribute, but I'm contributing it under, say, a GPL or a BSD license so that other people can build on my work without any restrictions from me. Mm-hmm. So projects go both ways. There are projects that do copyright assignment and projects that just simply take contributions, but the copyright remains in the original hands. The latter, of course, is much easier because you don't have to work with everybody. But if you ever want to change the overall license of the project, you have to go back to all those thousands of contributors or hundreds of contributors and say, we list is originally GPL2, can we put it under GPL3 now or something like that? Whereas when you assign copyrights, then there's essentially a central owner and they can decide, oh, okay, now this is now going to be under Apache style license instead of the previous license. Like I said, so they both have trade-offs. And projects go both ways on that. There's no consensus for which is better.
Gotcha. All right. Well, let's see how the world of open source is being treated by policymakers in Washington these days. The IRS, the ever popular government agency, has reached an interesting decision regarding a company called Yorba, which was attempting to be an open source nonprofit under 501c3. The IRS decided that Yorba could not qualify for Section 501c3, would not be given nonprofit status. And the reason that it made that declaration is it's really problematic for the open source world in general. The IRS decided that Yorba software, like any open source software, could potentially be used for commercial purposes. What the IRS said was you have a substantial non-exempt purpose because non-exempt being commercial, because you develop software published under open source compatible license that authorize use by any person for any purpose, including non-exempt purposes such as commercial, recreational, or personal purposes. And also goes on to talk about how the software could be used for partisan political purposes as well. So this seems like quite a blow to the open source world, wouldn't you say, Randall?
Yeah, I was particularly troubled about this, and it's clearly a huge about face from the IRS. Another reason I said earlier that open source software is no longer novel, we're actually now under mainstream fire. And it's very troubling in the sense that, hundreds of open source organizations have gotten 501c3 in the past and had no difference in restriction from what Yorba applied for. So this is clearly a policy change. It might make it more likely for organizations like, I have to disclose, I'm on the board of Linux Fund. And what we do is we, as a 501c3, we can accept donations and pass those along to qualifying organizations. But the organizations don't have to be 501c3 as long as they're within our particular purview that we have our agreement under. It might mean that more organizations like Linux Fund have to show up to be able to take donations in the U.S. I also have to say that this is not something that will affect a lot of organizations, even those that don't have 501c3, because you're still, as an organization, you can fund out of your corporate profits, funding of these sorts of organizations to make things happen. So it's really only we're talking about the individuals who want to give donations and how they can get a tax write-off for that. And like I said, there's always going to be organizations like Linux Fund and others, Linux Foundation, and let's say I'm not going to list all 1,000 of them, but they're out there that will be able to be sort of the buffer. So you can donate to them, get a tax deduction in the U.S., and then they can in turn around and give money to these. Now, if the IRS goes after the second level organizations like Linux Fund, I don't know where we're going to go. I mean, this is ridiculous. The fact that you can use freely developed software for commercial purposes, and that disqualifies the freely developed software organization as being a nonprofit, doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't. The ruling was just crazy when I read about it.
Yeah, it does seem like a really controversial decision by the IRS, and one that I'm sure they're going to come under fire for. We'll have to watch and see what happens to all those open source nonprofits that have already garnered 501c3 status, and see if there's any kind of revocation that's coming down the pipes for them. Let's take a break here and thank our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Law, which is Personal Capital. This is a really great time, I think. You know, summertime is when I at least get to take stock of what's going on in my personal life and make sure that all those ducks in a row. It's when I finally get around to keeping those resolutions that I might have made around New Year's time. And Personal Capital is a great tool if you find yourself in the same vein here in July. It is a free and secure tool that solves two barriers to growing your wealth. That first barrier is that it's hard to keep track of your stocks, your 401k, your bank accounts, et cetera. All your financial pieces all live on different sites with different usernames and passwords, assuming that you even have online access to that kind of stuff. And the second is that you might be paying someone to manage those accounts for you. You might very well be paying too much. So Personal Capital brings all your accounts and assets together for you on one single screen on your computer, phone, or tablet with real-time and intuitive graphs. This week, Personal Capital announced the integration of its award-winning app with Android Wear, available for download in Google Play. The Watch app seamlessly integrates with Personal Capital and other Android devices and provides users with relevant and timely updates on their finances whenever and wherever they need it. Personal Capital shows how much you're overpaying in fees and how to reduce those fees. You also get tailored advice on optimizing your investments. So why wait? Signing up takes just a minute, and it will pay you big dividends in the long run. Personal Capital gives you total clarity and transparency to make better investment decisions right away. So go ahead and set up your free account. Check it out at personalcapital.com/twill. It's free, and it's the smart way to grow your money. You must go to personalcapital.com/twill to take advantage of that. personalcapital.com/twill. Thank you so much, Personal Capital, for your support of This Week in Law. Speaking of New Year's resolutions, a lot of people make fitness ones, and we have a legal story related to that. A company named Appurio has managed to save itself $300,000 on its insurance premiums by giving its employees Fitbits, which caused me, and I'm sure I'm not the only person, to wonder about other companies that might decide, well, hey, you know, if we can save money on insurance, then all of our employees must use Fitbits or something else and must hit certain goals and targets and things. So this is kind of a privacy story and kind of a fitness story. And I know that, Randall, you're a big fan of Fitbit.
Actually, I do wear a Fitbit, but it's not because I'm first off, I've got to back up a second. For those people who listen to me on Floss Weekly, they know the story here already, but I was grossly overweight about 2 years ago and decided to do something about it and went on a low-carb, high-fat diet, ketogenic diet, lost 45 pounds in 6 months without any additional exercise because the old eat less, move more is actually totally flawed, which is where the problem I have with this story is that you're talking about health by having people move more or probably measuring people with BMI and things like that that are really irrelevant. And I disagree with that sort of intrusion because it doesn't allow people then to make their own individual choices about what they want to do with this. And it certainly didn't work for me up until the time I discovered LCHF. So I'm really questioning the values here. We're putting more and more emphasis on things that actually we found over the last 30 years don't work.
Yeah, David Sedaris has a really funny story in The New Yorker about his experience with Fitbit, how, it, you know, obviously he's not forced to use it by any means, and neither were the Appurio employees, but I'm just sort of thinking down the road to, you know, any way that companies can do cost cutting is certainly something that you might find rolled out in a mandatory way. And David Sedaris is... experience was that he became kind of a slave to his Fitbit and would go and do things with his life that otherwise he wouldn't do just to get that response from his Fitbit that he'd hit his goal for the day. And he writes, why is it that some people can manage a thing like a Fitbit while others go off the rails and allow it to rule and perhaps even ruin their lives? So I'm not using one of these devices. I've certainly thought about it. But I do think the privacy considerations when you bring it into the enterprise is something to view with caution. Appurio, according to one of the articles in our discussion points, this one at SiteWorld, has been careful about giving users privacy controls so that the program feels like a benefit for them and not a tool that the company uses to keep an eye on them. They can opt into many aspects, including getting their band to begin with, joining a team, and also having it, I guess Chatter is the corporate equivalent, an intranet Twitter kind of tool. And if it's going to broadcast that to your coworkers, you have control over that too. Evan, what do you think about this kind of development?
Oh, what a terrible invasion. Next thing you know, employers are going to have the decision whether they have to fund all forms of contraception for their employees. You know, what's the world coming to here? So, well, no, I mean, clearly we've got a, you know, there is a balance that has to be made here between privacy and the real, tangible, quantifiable benefits. Setting aside what Randall's saying, whether or not that we're looking at the right measure here, the real benefit to the employer, and hopefully it's a business benefit across the board because of that increase on the bottom line there, there's a real quantifiable benefit on the savings for insurance here. So that seems like a benefit we want to maximize. It's a good thing we want to maximize. But, you know, let's make sure that we establish some protocols here that do more than just, you know, making sure that these representations about the employee's privacy are more than just lip service, but that that actually is real and it's not being too invasive to sort of cross some normative standard here. I don't think that there's a real privacy interest in the pure kind of Fourth Amendment sense on the part of the employee here, because you could always quit your job and go somewhere else, right? We know that, but, you know, there still is this idea of it just seems something that we don't really like for employers to assert too much say into the personal lives, what employees are doing off the clock. It's probably the same part of the brain that gets revved up when we think of employers trying to ban employees from smoking or making other decisions. So, you know, maybe employees have some basic fundamental right to be lazy slobs. Maybe that's where it ultimately plays out here. So, I mean, you can see there's a bunch of different moving parts. I think there's a net benefit if we can do it correctly, is what I guess I'm trying to say.
There's a difference between a right to be a lazy slob and a right to, you know, make your own decisions about how healthy you're going to be.
Oh, come
and
on.
I guess
I wasn't seeing it yes. That black and white. I know.
Okay. I get it. What were you going to say, Deidre?
I was going to say I'm fascinated by the fact that one of the things that it records is how long you sleep, mm-hmm. right? Because I for sure, that's not information that I want my employer to have. Just saying.
Right. Well, I don't use a Fitbit, but at one point or another, and I've stopped using it years ago, I had an app on my iPhone that was, you know, it operated like a Fitbit. It didn't, you know, it did not actually track pulse or anything, but it relied on you to tell the app what you'd done for exercise throughout the day. And you could put in various activities and it would tell you how many calories you'd burned. And it was like a weight management tool, and it would make a plan for you based on your activities, et cetera. And one of the activities it tracked was sexual activity. You know, if you were willing to put that into the app, does Fitbit go that far, Randall?
Not with the current installation. It's not that I've seen anyway.
Certainly there are calories to be burned that way.
Yes. Yes, I wear a Fitbit for sleep analysis, actually. I wear it during the day, and I have it set at a real modest 3,000 steps, and I almost hit that almost every day, and that's just walking out to the car and back. I mean, it's not really that much that far, but I do actually wear one to watch my sleep, and I'm actually paying attention to the fact that I actually sleep longer than I thought I would. I thought longer than I thought I do, and I wake up a lot less than I thought I did, which is sort of amazing, so... For that purpose, it's a useful diagnostic for me, but I don't use it to hit goals. I don't really care. It is sort of curious sometimes when I find out that I climbed up 17 flights of stairs today, you know, or something like that. And those are usually airport days. And my airport days have numbers that are really outrageous compared to all the other days since I fly a lot. It's about one day out of every 2 weeks. It's like this huge spike in all my graphs and stuff. So
interesting. So you're in the middle of some travel now. So you're getting your money out of your Fitbit at the moment. Okay, so let's your personal data about your health triggers some sort of concern, I would say, for all of us as to who gets to see that and use it and use it for cost savings or anything else. I think it's really interesting to think about exactly what is property these days. And the intersection between data and property. And Deidre, you've written a really interesting article from a philosophical standpoint on property and persons. It's getting down to, you know, what exactly is property and what triggers a property right that might be saleable in some way or another. Can you give us some background on that, your preliminary thoughts, and try and put it in the context of, you know, whether it's Fitbit data or Facebook data or anything else that we deal with in today's world, and try and keep to ourselves or share? And if we're going to share it, expect some sort of return for that.
Right. So if we're going to share it, who owns it? Right. I mean, I think that's the question in the Fitbit context, particularly where the Fitbit is provided by your employer. Then that data, if you choose to share it, is that data then the employer's data? Right. If so, let's say I decide that I work for the company that we're talking about, and I decide I'm going to take the Fitbit, right? And I'm going to use it, and I'm going to use the chatter function. And so all of the information about how many steps I take and how much I sleep and all that stuff is shared with my employer. When I leave that employer at some point, does that data get scrubbed from their databases, or do they still have that data available to them? Right? Mm-hmm. Those are questions that this technology poses, that Facebook poses, right? The question, so there was this story this week about Facebook, about the Facebook study, the manipulating emotions study. Did you guys see this?
Yes, definitely.
Okay. So similar kinds of questions presented, right? How much does engagement with these new technologies divest you of a right to privacy, divest you of your interest in that information? And those are questions that are sort of live, right? But the paper that you referenced, how it's sort of related to this conversation, is that in that paper, I want to argue, and let's be clear that that paper only exists right now in my mind, right? in that paper, I want to argue that there are certain things, the right to privacy being one of them, and stated more specifically, autonomy, that belong to me, that are inalienable, right? I can't give away my autonomy. I can't sell my autonomy, nor should I be able to, right? It is inherent in being a person that I have this autonomy. And so I think in the employer-provided Fitbit context, there's a question there, right, about how much of that autonomy you're giving over to your employer and how much of your privacy with it. And so, yeah, I'm glad to hear Randall say that in this iteration, Fitbit doesn't record sexual activity, but surely there's stuff short of that that I don't necessarily want to share with my employer, even if I'm engaged in this wellness program, right? Yeah, I think that these are interesting questions that are becoming more and more relevant as we sort of engage in this social media more.
Yeah. And what's your take on personal data as property? Do you think that there's a monetizable property interest there?
I think that the personal data gets aggregated and monetized all the time, right? I mean, this is sort of what Google does, right?
But what about for the individual?
Is it monetizable by me?
Yeah.
Not in any way that I can think of at the moment, right? I'm sure go ahead, Denise, I'm sorry.
Would you want it to be?
No.
Do you think that it should be?
No, I don't think that it should be.
Okay, why not?
Because I think that the interest that I have in my personal data is a privacy interest. That's that's more protectable. That's something that I want protected to a higher level than my interest in my stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would say it's a dignitary interest and not a property interest.
Do you think that treating it as a property interest gives individuals some sort of bargaining power with whether it's employers or social media sites or other sites, Google, you mentioned, and anybody who's trying to gather information about them and use it themselves, do you think treating it as a property interest might help in that regard?
I don't think so, because I think what ends up happening is then my interest in my personal data is on the same plane as your interest in my personal data, right? Mm-hmm. And it's a question of sort of who has the most money, right? Mm-hmm. Am I going to go to court and fight with my property interest against your property interest, right? Whereas, so my thinking about this is really that that's a question of my privacy, which is more important than any property interest that can be asserted, right? So if I can articulate a way in which my privacy is being invaded by your claims to property, then I should win in that fight. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does. Randall, what do you think about this whole notion of data as a personally protected privacy interest or perhaps a property interest?
Well, I know, I keep thinking of HIPAA coming into play here, that the, mm-hmm. we have a reason for laws like that, where our personal, our personal data is ours. I get concerned now that employers are trying to figure out some way to either bypass HIPAA by the fact that you've got an employment contract or something to get that away. And I like the concern about, what if I leave the company? Yeah. I mean, does my data have to get destroyed, or does it in backup tapes for years, or what? And also, to what degree can these companies collude then and share the data back and forth and have that define whether I can be on the company health insurance or whatever the levels around? Of course, that opens a whole other can of worms of employers to get out of the health market. But let's not go there.
Yeah, that's agreed, a really interesting. Randall. That's a really interesting consideration if you think about employers and Fitbit. Getting back to our earlier story. Because I am no HIPAA lawyer and I have no idea, what it covers, all of the nuances of that law. But it seems to me like it might be aimed more at your relationship with a medical services provider than it is your relationship with something that is monitoring your day-to-day physical activity. So that I could certainly see where HIPAA could come into play here, but I could see where it might not too, just because there's not a doctor involved in what's going on between you and the Fitbit. Evan, we're talking about property interests and data and whether data, personal data, should be more privacy or property. Did you want to weigh in on that at all before we move on?
Well, just to say that, I mean, it would be intimidating to talk too much about that with Deidre on the conversation as well, because I know she's written about this from a scholarly perspective. And
she corrected me on that, and let me jump in. I thought that you had written this article already, Deidre. I did not know that this was just a work in progress at the moment, but it's a fascinating topic.
Good. Well, in any event, I mean, I don't know that it's going to ultimately be helpful for us to decide whether it has to be a property interest or some other kind of alternative interest. I think that we can best regulate this and best develop a normative approach for a community-wide culture, society-wide understanding about how to treat the privacy / dignitary interest of an individual based on the types of harms that arise from when lines are crossed. So it's the starting point, I would think, doesn't have to be like, okay, yes, this is a property interest, ergo, this is how it's going to be regulated, A, B, C. We've just got to look at it from a more general, a broader standpoint and say, these are the harms that we seek to protect against, because ultimately, it's not going to make much sense. It's going to be, it's going to sort of see some anachronisms, probably a lot like what we see in copyright law. If we think of the starting point as being a property interest, well, it can't really be a property interest because it's not like this pencil. It's not something that I hold. It's not chattel, my privacy interest. So it's just sort of like, it's like copyright. It doesn't make any sense to think of it from the starting point as making copies anymore. There's something much more important at risk, things like the right of access, right of distribution. Just like with privacy, the main interest is keeping me from harm, from having people whom I don't want to know information about me coming into contact and knowledge of that information. So how's that for sort of a cop-out answer? You know, it's just sort of saying, well, let's just try to keep bad things from happening.
I think that works, Evan. I think that's a great answer, actually. And I think we're saying very much the same thing. And I agree with you 100% that the copyright as property thing is problematic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's just that it's a different world. It's an information based economy in large part now. So these ideas that are sort of hardwired into our brain structures of coming at it from the perspective of chattel sort of break down after a certain point. So good.
Yes. This, and yet courts insist on doing it anyway, right? Courts insist on saying this intellectual property, well, it's property. So therefore X, Y, Z flows from that determination, right?
Yes. Yep.
Yes. All right. So we'll look for a dangerous article, and hopefully it can help convince lawmakers everywhere that making sure nothing bad happens is the standard that we want to follow. All right. We've got a tip and a resource for you before we head on out of here. Our tip of the week is that the SCOTUS blog is not SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States. If you had any confusion on that front, allow us to set it aside. SCOTUS blog is the be-all, end-all resource for all decisions going up to and coming out of the Supreme Court, but it is not the Supreme Court itself. Evan mentioned the Hobby Lobby decision earlier that recently came from the Supreme Court was very controversial and caused a lot of anger, and some of that anger got directed at SCOTUS blog on Twitter as opposed to at the actual Supreme Court of the United States site. I'm not sure if they have an account or not. Maybe someone can look that up for me while we talk about this. But SCOTUS blog certainly does and was getting terribly irate tweets thrown their way, which they responded to in a kind of a wonderful way. Somebody tweeted them, you, and I'm going to edit the language a bit, messed this up real hard today. Go read the bleep First Amendment again. Okay. And SCOTUS blog replies with, oops, lost our copy. Sorry about that. Various other ways that they were trying to let people gently know you are aiming this ire in the wrong direction. So don't be confused. It's easy to be confused. A partner at my former law firm got confused once and went ahead and said some very nasty things to SCOTUS blog, thinking again that it was the Supreme Court that his ire was directed at. So be careful on Twitter and don't get confused. All right. Our resources of the week that we have two. Number one is a list that comes from Law Street. Various lists get published of who the top 10 law schools for various subjects are. This one is the top 10 law schools for intellectual property, in case you might be interested in that. George Washington University Law School got number one on this list, with a tie for number two between the University of New Hampshire School of Law and Santa Clara University School of Law, where our friend Professor Goldman teaches. He, you know, just having him anywhere, I think, would get you in the top five of the list for sure. And so if you're interested in that, if you're interested in the kinds of topics that we discuss on This Week in Law and looking at law schools where you might want to either attend or teach, this list might give you some guidance. And speaking of George Washington University School of Law, topping that list, they have an event coming up next week on July 16th. That would be a great resource to check out to look for, I'm sure, the tweets from this event coming up. It is the Internet Governance Forum USA for 2014. It's going to be July 16th at George Washington University. It is a domestic forum in the U.S. for civil society, government, technologists, research scientists, the media industry, and academia, and all other interested communities to engage in dialogue about the development and best practices for multi-stakeholder governance of the internet and moving its policy forward. So something to keep an eye on there coming up next week. And with that, I guess we'll go ahead and thank you all for a wonderful episode of This Week in Law. Randall, it's been too long. I'm so glad that we finally got you on the show, and congratulations on episode 300 of Floss Weekly.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
It's been a real pleasure. Anything else coming up on the show? You want to tell us who you have coming up as guests next week, or any other things that you might want to share with our audience?
Sure. Yeah. The next couple of weeks, we're actually going to be OSCON focused. Next week, we're going to talk about the new kids project, kids programs that are happening at OSCON. We've got the Simon St. Laurent coming on to talk about that, and also Aaron Gupta. And then the following week, we're actually live from OSCON, and OSCON, the open source convention, often gives us, we've often got a scoop there because people announce things at OSCON and we can interview the people right there. So it's, I'm hoping for another scoop, 2 weeks from now, but I don't know what it is until we're there. So stay tuned.
Very cool. All right. We definitely will do that. Thank you so much. And yeah. Deidre Keller, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you. You're doing some great work. We, so appreciate your taking the time to join us today.
Thanks, Denise. Thanks, Evan. It was nice to meet you guys.
For sure.
Nice to meet you, too. Are you working a lot over the summer or just kind of gearing up for fall rapidly approaching you?
I'm teaching law and literature this summer. So
very good.
That's my fun class.
Yeah, law and literature would be a good one. What are the books that you have on your curriculum for that?
Yeah, we read Susan Glaspell's A Jury of Her Peers and Melville's Bartleby, The Scrivener, and Toni Morrison's Home this year.
No Bleak House this year?
No Bleak House.
All right.
Sorry.
You'll have to get that one at a later time. Thanks so much for joining us. Anything going on with you aside from your law and lit class that you'd like to let people know about? Anything coming up?
No, I'm about to go on vacation. Super excited about that.
All right. Also, I realized we've gone the whole show with the ONU Law Twitter handle in your lower third. Are you on Twitter at all if people would want to follow you there?
I'm not on Twitter. I haven't figured out the whole 140 character thing.
All right. And you have figured out the privacy interest in your data thing. So good for you. Evan, you're on Twitter, even though you're a very privacy conscious guy.
I am. Yeah. I'll say some things. Nobody cares anyway. So why not just go ahead and put it out there. So, but yeah, fun episode. Randall, really fun talking to you as we expected. And Deidre, really interesting to talk with you and hear about the work that you've got going on, something like that. So
something
good times.
Like that.
Yeah.
Good times. Very good times. Evan, how about you? Are you speaking anywhere soon or working on anything you want to let us know about?
Well, I should have something in the works, I guess. I'm sort of kind of on a down, or at least on a rest day today. I spoke to at a conference yesterday here in Chicago to a group of about 300 defense counsel. There's a big insurer here in town, and I spoke on social media as evidence. You know, it's the scope of what's discoverable and what have you there. But that's past. So that's sort of what I've been looking for the last few weeks. So I'll let you know. There should be something coming up pretty exciting here soon. You know, it's hard to stay silent for too long.
Yes, it is. And I loved Evan's Twitter feed because you always find the great little gems, Evan, whether there's always something funny and ironic in the things that you find and tweet about. So definitely if you're not following him, he's Internet Cases on Twitter. I'm D Howell over there. You can get in touch with us by email, of course. I am Denise at twit.tv. Evan is Evan at twit.tv. We love hearing from you between the shows or on Google Plus or on Facebook. If you need more than 140 characters, which often people do. So we just love hearing from you in any and all forms. I was listening to your intro to your episode 300, Randall, and listening to your discussion about the importance of audience participation in your development of material for Floss Weekly. And we very much feel that way here at Twill too. We love hearing from you about who you think we should have on the show, what you think we should discuss, what important issues that were out there that have not yet hit our radar. So please definitely reach out to us and let us know what you'd like to see. That's very, very helpful for us. And we just love knowing what's on your minds. So definitely take advantage of all of the channels that I mentioned. And if you want to go back and watch older episodes of the show, or you can't join us live when we record every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC, head on over to twit.tv/twill. That's where you'll find the whole archive of our shows, as well as there's a YouTube channel if that works better for you. We're This Week in Law on YouTube, and we're on iTunes and the Roku and various other ways that you like to consume this kind of entertainment. We're going to be there for you, and we'll certainly be there for you next week. We hope you'll join us then on This Week in Law. Take care.